Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure with today's top stories. Thanks for joining me. Coming up, Pope Benedict visits Regensburg, the German town where he taught theology for almost a decade. And careful steps. 1 month after a truce brought calm to Lebanon, a look at how the Lebanese are coping. Those who believe are never alone. A simple but all-encompassing truth that Pope Benedict chose as a theme for his six-day apostolic journey to Germany. And to see the Pope surrounded by tens of thousands of enthusiastic faithful at events throughout this trip, it would be hard to think of him as ever feeling lonely. And indeed, since his arrival in Germany on Saturday, the faithful have embraced their Pope with a joy and exuberance that have visibly made the former Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger feel at home in the places of his youth. One of those places is the Bavarian town of Regensburg, where the Pope arrived Monday evening to what some described as a hero's welcome, with crowds cheering and waving as his motorcade made its way to Regensburg Major Seminary, where he spent the night. Regensburg holds a special place in the Pope's heart. It was here that he taught dogmatic theology for 8 years, from 1969 until his election to the episcopacy in 1977. Well, it was with those very words, "Those who believe are never alone," that Pope Benedict began his homily Tuesday at an open-air Mass in Regensburg. He was thanking the faithful for their warm greetings, but at the same time reminding them of the purpose of his visit, to proclaim God's love for each and every one of us. Chris Altieri was there and can tell us more about the morning's Mass and what the Pope had to say.
More than 250,000 pilgrims converged on a white sanctuary recently built in the middle of a vast field at Isling, a short distance outside the cathedral city of Regensburg in Bavaria. On that field, at 10 on Tuesday morning, with scores of bishops and hundreds of priest concelebrants present, Pope Benedict celebrated Mass in honor of the Feast of the Most Holy Name of Mary.
Im Namen des Vaters und des Sohnes und des Heiligen Geistes. Amen. Der Friede sei mit euch.
Starting in the early morning, groups of religious and lay faithful led the gathering pilgrims in hymn and prayer, especially in Marian hymns and the Rosary of the Blessed Virgin. A famous image of Mary, patroness of Bavaria, adorned the sanctuary. The image is one of Mary with her arms outstretched, shielding the people of Bavaria, whose faces are gathered under the protective covering of Mary's robes. Also prominently displayed was a massive wooden crucifix in the form of a capital T, which usually hangs in the chapel of the Regensburg Major Seminary. In 1991, restoration artists found hidden inside the wood two reliquaries and a small handcrafted leather pouch. The pouch contained a life-size silver butterfly with pearl-tipped antennae and perfectly lifelike lacquered wings. The butterfly is an ancient Christian symbol of resurrection. The seminary is dedicated to the 10th century bishop of Regensburg, St. Wolfgang, and is serving as the papal residence in Regensburg. During the offertory procession, the faithful of Regensburg presented a 3-foot-tall statue of St. Wolfgang, realized in wood and decorated in gold. At the beginning of the Mass, Pope Benedict thanked the faithful and once again spoke briefly of how happy he is to be in his homeland.
Wer glaubt, ist nie allein, haben wir eben gesungen. Und wir sehen es, wie der Glaube uns versammelt. Und ich danke allen, die dazu geholfen haben, dass wir dieses Fest des Glaubens.
Then the Holy Father led the faithful in the penitential rites, which culminated in the singing of the Kyrie in 8-part polyphony. The music of the Mass was carefully chosen to present a harmony of styles, and after the readings, at the Gospel acclamation, the sound of trumpets rang out to herald the good news of salvation, and continued through the Mass to punctuate the celebration. At the beginning of his homily, Pope Benedict expressed heartfelt gratitude to all those who worked to prepare for his visit, and especially for the Mass at Isligerfeld. Pope Benedict continued, saying that modern atheism is rooted in a faulty understanding of God's true nature, which leads to an unhealthy fear of him. Today, said Pope Benedict, we know about what he called the life-threatening diseases associated with religion and reason, and the ways that God's image can be destroyed by hatred and fanaticism. The Holy Father said it is important to state clearly the God in whom we believe, and to proclaim confidently that this God has a human face. At the end of the homily, Pope Benedict remembered his mother and sister, who were both called Mary, and said his best wishes to all Marias who today celebrate their name day. After the Mass, Pope Benedict led the faithful in singing the Subtuum Presidium, a centuries-old prayer imploring the protection of Mary.
Well, on Monday, the Pope was in the Bavarian town of Altötting, a little under 100 kilometers from Regensburg. There, he presided an open-air Mass in the morning and inaugurated the Chapel of the Adoration in the town's shrine. Another highlight of the day was a Marian Vesper service, which the Pope presided at the Basilica of St. Anne in Altötting. Chris Altieri filed this report with more.
After a brief afternoon visit in Altötting's Church of St. Conrad, Pope Benedict entered the neo-Baroque Basilica of St. Anne with its soaring vaulted ceilings and a massive pipe organ ensconced above the portico. There, the Holy Father celebrated the church's liturgy of evening prayer. St. Anne was the mother of Our Lady, and these Vespers were specially dedicated to Mary, her daughter, the mother of Our Lord and patroness of Bavaria. The priests, religious, and especially the seminarians of Bavaria were guests of honor along with members of the pontifical work for vocations.
In der Basilika der Heiligen Anna, gegenüber dem Heiligtum ihrer Tochter, der Mutter des Herrn, versammelt.
In his homily, the Holy Father used the gospel image of the harvest to describe the work of evangelization still to be done everywhere, from Asia, Africa, and Latin America, to Russia and the Pope's own homeland as well, where he said a great harvest could still be reaped. The Pope asked all those present to pray that the Lord might take pity on the world and send good workers out into the field. The Pope also spoke directly to the priests, religious, and seminarians present, encouraging them to be courageous and faithful in following the Lord, and also giving what we might call some practical advice, speaking of the Liturgy of the Hours and Eucharistic Adoration as indispensable elements of a healthy priestly and religious spirituality, and recommending the humility of St. Conrad, who renounced his inheritance to live his life as a porter in the convent near St. Anne's. There was a powerful moment at the end of the Vesper service when Pope Benedict left the ring he had worn as Cardinal Archbishop of Munich and Freising at the base of the 14th century statue of Our Lady, known as the Black Madonna, which had been brought into the Basilica for the liturgy. Outside the Basilica, amid the cheers and applause of thousands gathered on the Altötting Commons, Pope Benedict signed the Golden Book of the city and received the plaque that will sign the newly named Pope Benedict Square in Altötting. Civic representatives also gave the Holy Father a white, wide-brimmed fedora hat with a black band, which the Pope happily donned to the delight of thousands of pilgrims. After a several minutes exchange of festive greetings and salutations with people in the crowd, the Holy Father made his way to the heliport and boarded his helicopter for a quick hop to his birthplace, Marktl, where, with his brother Georg at his side, Pope Benedict prayed at the font that held and caught the waters of his baptism in the parish church of St. Oswald on Holy Saturday in 1927. The streets of the tiny town on the Inn River were lined 4, 5, and 6 thick with well-wishers, and it seemed the Holy Father wanted to shake absolutely everyone's hand. The Pope walked positively sprightly around a bronze column that used the figures of St. Benedict of Nursia and Pope Benedict XVI to tell the story of the spread of the gospel. Again, Pope Benedict spent several minutes in greeting the townsfolk before returning to the Popemobile and heading for the ball field in Marktl, where his helicopter landed. Before reaching the helicopter, however, the Pope stopped the motorcade to go and greet the people one last time. Pope Benedict then flew to Regensburg, where he spent the night in the major seminary. From Bavaria, I'm Chris Altieri.
And be sure to tune in to the English feature program with Philippa Hitchin this Wednesday. She'll be taking a look at Pope Benedict's widely anticipated discourse to scientists and academics at the University of Regensburg. Again, that's Wednesday, September 13th, right here on the English feature program. Other news stories making the headlines, little attention has been given recently in the international media to Lebanon, where UN truce stopped major fighting between Israel and Hezbollah militants almost 1 month ago. The UN Security Council resolution leading to the ceasefire called for 15,000 UN troops to join about the same number of Lebanese army troops deploying in the south of the country. But while the peacekeepers slowly deploy and the country struggles to begin the momentous task of rebuilding, how are Lebanon's people coping? A delegation of members of the Catholic Aid and Development umbrella organization, Caritas Internationalis, is in Lebanon to find out. Owen Murray of the Irish Catholic organization Trocare spoke to me from Beirut about the humanitarian situation and the mood among the Lebanese.
I should say for your listeners that I'm standing in the middle of one of the Palestinian refugee camps as I talk to you, and it's a hot, stuffy, miserable, crazy, busy place. So if they hear certain sound effects in the background, that might explain why. But we've traveled to the Bekaa Valley, which is in the east of Lebanon, and we traveled to the south of Lebanon as well. And we saw a variety of mixed villages, Christian villages, Muslim villages, and we met people on the ground there who'd suffered throughout the war. In the Bekaa Valley, really the kind of destruction that we witnessed was very targeted against the economy. So, for example, you would find glass factories or milk factories that we visited that had been completely destroyed. 3-ton bombs dropped on them from F-16s. And it was really a targeting of the civilian infrastructure as well and the way to these areas, the roads, the bridges and so on. As you move down south into Lebanon and also in South Beirut, what you find is that while the civilian infrastructure has been targeted, also there's been heavy fighting in the villages, be they, as I said, Christian or Muslim or mixed. No one has escaped the horrors of this war. I think in terms of what people are feeling now is some degree of optimism. At least they're happy that the intensity of the conflict has come to an end. But people are still worried that it could flare up again. That's always a risk. There's also an increase in some of the sectarian tensions which had existed beforehand. And I think one of the messages to send out in particular is that we heard from Lebanese Christians about how they were so concerned that they were being ignored by the international Christian community, that they were feeling very isolated in Lebanon as organizations like Hezbollah and some of the Islamic states were looking after the Muslim population primarily, whereas they were a lot more isolated and their situation wasn't quite on the headlines of the news. So they were concerned, and many of the young people who we met who'd been volunteering with Caritas during its emergency response, many of the young people we met were talking about looking for opportunities to leave. You know, how could they find a way of leaving Lebanon and not coming back to this country where they saw very little prospect for stability and for long-term peace?
Though the war with Israel lasted just 34 days, the Lebanese remember all too well the other civil war that gripped their nation for nearly 17 years. It was one of the most vicious and bloody sectarian wars in recent memory. In the years since that conflict ended in 1990, many Lebanese who had fled the fighting had returned home, rediscovering what seemed to be the stability and peace they were so desperate for. They were rebuilding, investing. The future looked bright. But the fear now is that many of Lebanon's young people, the country's very future, again will take flight. And many of them are Christians from what is one of the biggest Christian communities in the Middle East. But let's go back to the situation of the refugees, those who have stuck it out in Lebanon, only to return home to the south to find wholesale destruction. George Khoury is executive director of Caritas Lebanon.
They are, you know, very busy fixing their houses all together. And those who have their homes completely destroyed are trying to settle in tents or with other groups, with other families in the same village, so they would be close to the area and place where they are rebuilding and restarting their normal life.
What sort of problems are you encountering as you try to provide assistance to these people? I would imagine that the roads are very difficult.
Roads are very difficult, and what the people are doing now is in some way creating substitute for the roads, and especially for the bridges, because 95% of the bridges in the south area have been knocked down by the Israeli air bombing. The second problem, and which is very difficult, is unexploded bombs and shells. And they have what they call grapes bombs, which are disseminated in the fields, so they are not able to start their farming.
Right. I think you're talking about cluster bombs.
Yes.
So how concerned are aid workers, too, about these unexploded munitions in southern Lebanon? It would affect also their being able to get aid assistance to these people.
We are going through the same risk, the people are doing, you know, but for the rescuers and for the organization's workers, we are not much exposed because we don't go in the field. We stick to the roads, the main roads.
Now, I know that Hezbollah has been handing out something like $300 million to victims of the war to help them after their homes were destroyed. They're helping to rebuild, finding temporary housing for people and furniture.
Yes.
How does their distribution network compare, say, to what the government is doing and what aid agencies are able to supply?
You know, the government and the aid agencies are slow, and they have to process all requests and surveys and assessment of needs, while the Hezbollah has started immediately handing over cash grants to people according to the extent of damages. For those who have their homes completely destroyed, they are providing something, you know, like $13,000, U.S. dollars, so that with this money, they would go and find a temporary shelter. They rent a house and they buy the necessary furniture to wait until their homes being rebuilt by the Hezbollah.
So Hezbollah is actually rebuilding as well?
Yes, it's rebuilding as well.
In the United States, I just recently returned from there, and some in the media were commenting that Hezbollah has been far more efficient in helping victims in Lebanon than the U.S. government was in helping people after the Hurricane Katrina, which hit New Orleans.
In fact, it's true. It's true because, you know, representatives from the Hezbollah, and they are highly organized, so they are going into the villages by groups, you know, and it's not one team who is implementing. They have several teams going around, you know, in each village. They have their team who is handing over the assistance. Most of it goes into cash.
I was watching one report over the weekend in which even a Christian family was receiving some compensation from Hezbollah. Is that something common?
Yes, yes. Some Christians have received, you know, assistance from Hezbollah. But, you know, it's done in coordination with a political Christian group.
Are you with Caritas working together with Hezbollah to provide assistance?
No. But we are, you know, trying to follow up with what Hezbollah is doing in order to avoid duplication.
So how are you able to, I can't find a better word, to compete with the what seems to be a very efficient system of Hezbollah? How can
you are using the right proper word and term to say it. We cannot go into competition with Hezbollah. Under no circumstances we are going to get $13,000 U.S. dollars per capita per house or per family.
And the Lebanese government can't do that either.
The Lebanese government won't be able to do it too, you know.
And I think the first thing to say is that we shouldn't be trying to compete with Hezbollah or with the Islamic State because they have huge resources. Secondly, there's no doubt that Hezbollah is giving at least some money to the Christian populations, and they are trying to take account to some degree, a limited degree, of their needs. It would be virtually impossible, as you say, to compete given the resources that they have, and certainly organizations from Caritas around the world wouldn't be able to match that, and also they wouldn't be able to match the style of giving. There's no way we could just suddenly give, you know, thousands of dollars to each family to pay rent or to rebuild their home. Our rules, our structures, our procedures wouldn't allow that. So I think what we have to do is try and find a way where we can target the people, you know, obey our humanitarian imperative and target the people who are most in need, but also to look at the people who are receiving the least assistance and to try and help them as well. And it's got to be a balance somewhere in between the two, and that's where we can make a real contribution.
You know, because of what the church teaching is, you know, we cannot work with discrimination. We cannot discriminate in our assistance. So we are trying to provide in as much as we can equally to the neediest of the needy. So this is why it takes us some time before we start. While Hezbollah is not looking into what the social condition of a beneficiary could be, they are systematically, you know, giving to every single damaged or destroyed house. They are not much concerned about the social situation of the recipients.
Prior to the war, there were some tensions between communities. There were those who wanted Hezbollah to disarm and those who justified their retention of arms because they see them as the liberators of Lebanon. How do people feel now after the war?
You know, it's a great controversy now. You know, there is some kind of incertitude dictating the attitude of the people toward what goes on. You know, if you get back to the pre-war situation, it's far different. People were afraid of Hezbollah because of his very sophisticated and highly armed and strong. They could not stand, you know, against Hezbollah. And until now, it hasn't been made clear if Hezbollah has lost or won the war. So people don't know where to stand.
What do you think will change this situation, this stalled situation?
You know, we are still waiting until the United Nations interim forces take over the control of the area and start, you know, to put into application the UN Resolution 1559 and 1701.
How hopeful are you that that will happen sometime soon?
We have always hoped to get to a better understanding and a better situation. But unless we see, we have become very doubtful about the development of the situation. So we are very cautious. And We are trying to avoid any kind of statement or whatever, with or against.
What has been the response of the Catholic Church in Lebanon to the crisis facing the country now? I know the Patriarch has been speaking out, has met with the bishops and with the leaders of the other faith communities. What have they been saying?
They are calling for solidarity. They are calling for peace. They are calling for understanding among different fractions of the population. And they have done in as much as they could through Caritas and other church-related organizations to come to rescue and to assist the affected population. We have given out food rations, hygiene kits, and medication. And we are trying to assist, you know, in medical services and, psychological
support.
Yes.
But what about the psychological support we Christians in the West can give to those in Lebanon, and indeed the wider Middle East, who, as Owen Murray said, feel abandoned by the universal church, by other Christians like you and me?
What I personally said to them is, we're here to see you, and we are concerned about your situation, and it is a worry for us. And we see that Christians across the Middle East, be it in Bethlehem or be it in Beirut, are being isolated. Their situation is being ignored, and it isn't, as I said, the headline news. I think we have to carry a very strong and special message back to our churches in Ireland and whatever the countries we come from, stating clearly that the churches need to express their solidarity. They need to come to see Christians in the Holy Land. They need to come to see Christians in Beirut and in South Lebanon and in the Bekaa Valley or in the north of Lebanon and in other parts of the Middle East, because the situation now that they're facing is one of extraordinary isolation and discomfort in terms of a social and a psychological well-being. So I think my message will be that leaders of the church from around the world, of all the churches, need to come and visit and to see the situation that people are living in, particularly for Christians, but also for Muslims, also for Druze, and also for the other religions spread across the Middle East, who are living through horrific wars, be it in Palestine, Iraq, or in Lebanon. And unless those visits are made, unfortunately, the Christians are going to continue to feel isolated.
And a very warm thanks to Owen Murray there from the Irish Catholic organization Trocare. He was speaking to me from Beirut. Also thanks to George Khoury, Executive Director of Caritas Lebanon, whom you heard earlier. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.